You're listening to the Brown Girl Podcast, a new show discussing various cultural and mainstream topics that impact our community from the perspectives of South Asian women. The show also aims to highlight South Asian women creators, business owners, and pioneers who are paving the way for future generations. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever your podcasts are found. If you're on Instagram, give us a follow at thebrowngirl_podcast to stay up to date on new releases and stay engaged with our community. Thanks for tuning in. Hey guys, welcome to the Brown Girl Podcast. My name is Julie. I am the host of this show. Thank you so much for listening today. This is episode number 15. It is the April 2022 episode release. So we just wrapped up three whole consecutive episodes about dating and relationships. That was a really popular topic of discussion. So if you haven't listened to those, go give those a listen. Okay, so for this month, we are talking about personal finance and money matters. April is Financial Literacy Month. This is a topic that I am particularly very passionate about and feel strongly about. So I'm really excited to talk with Parween Mander on the show today. I came across Parween through social media, and I'm really excited that she accepted my invitation to come on the show. A little bit about Parween. Parween is a South Asian money expert on a mission to provide honest and relatable financial coaching for women of color from immigrant upbringings through one-on-one coaching and mentoring. She built a net worth of $200,000 by the age of 28 and is on a mission to help other women of color overcome their financial traumas and build generational wealth. Parween is the founder of The Wealthy Wolf, holds the accredited Financial Counselor of Canada designation, and is a certified Trauma of Money facilitator. I hope you guys enjoy the show. Thank you so much for being here today. I have been following your content for some time, and I know you have a really unique story and background. So tell us about how you started your journey with money and, you know, building your own financial knowledge and literacy such to a point of now helping others as well.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much for having me, first of all, Julie, on the podcast. I'm so, so excited to be here and talk about a topic that not a lot of people love talking about, which is money and finances. So my money story really started when I was 16 years old, when we almost lost our childhood home, literally the one that I'm in right now. Mm-hmm. And at the time, being the eldest daughter in an immigrant household, I was responsible for translating, you know, what the bank representatives were saying to my parents regarding our mortgage, how we weren't approved, etc. So I was very overly exposed to adult financial matters at a young age. What that experience taught me, however, about money was, hey, if you lacked money, you lacked power, safety, and control. So in my mind, it became, well, if you have money, that must mean you mm-hmm. have all those things. So at the age of 16, I vowed to myself to become financially independent. 10 years later, by the age of 26, I built a 100K net worth. I have since doubled it at the age of 28 to 200K. And I'm really on a mission to empower other women of color from similar upbringings as myself to, you know, become financially independent. Because when I was on my money journey, trying to teach myself personal finance, there was no one out there that looked like me. Right? There's no one out there, you know, brown skinned or as a woman mm-hmm. and who can kind of relate to my experiences. So I am very, very, you know, thankful to be sort of in that position to, you know, fill that gap that I didn't have growing up.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine that to have been such a scarring and traumatic experience, you know, going through what you did. It would be traumatic as an adult, let alone being a teenager and having to take on that burden. So it's mm-hmm. so great to hear that, you know, you took something that was difficult and felt empowered by it to do better for yourself. And now, you know, helping others in the process. I totally related to what you said about not having anyone that looked like you to mm-hmm. you know, connect or relate to that could help you understand, like, really how to manage money. Like, I remember when I was 22 and right out of college, I was working at this big corporation. And I remember they had set up this session for new employees and had financial advisors come in to talk financial planning and retirement accounts and investing and things like that. Mm. And I remember going and just feeling so lost because the information was, one, presented in such a way that was just way over my head at the time. And then on top of that, it's like, you know, like all these middle-aged white men, and here I am, mm-hmm. 22, I'm feeling like super intimidated. And quite frankly, I think that just made it more difficult to ask questions and just get the help and advice that I needed. So I think it's so great that now there's people like you who are doing this work, who have, you know, that unique perspective of being young women of color, you know, child of immigrants, and you have those experiences that can help you relate to certain demographics and audiences.
Absolutely.
How do you work with your clients? Like, what is that process like when you take on one-on-one coaching? Like, what can people expect from working with you and going through your program?
Yeah, absolutely. So I offer a 3-month private one-on-one coaching program. And so I always get DMs or messages about, hey, can I just do a one-off call with you? And my response is always, no. So the reason why is because real change, you know, real sustainable results come from doing the work, you know, over a period of time. And that's why I have a 12-week program for that purpose. And I've designed my program to provide, you know, we start with the financial strategy of laying out your financial goals. Hey, where are you at right now? Do you have debt? Do you want to build your savings, start investing, etc.? Right? Getting my clients on a paycheck by paycheck budget plan, which again, when people hear the word budget, they cringe and they internally scream. And so my whole thing is I really want to make this process easy and simple for my clients to implement, right? No more than 5 or 6 minutes for them each month to create their next month's budget, right? And so we start with the strategy so my clients start to gain that confidence in themselves. Like, hey, you know what? I can do this, right? Yeah. I actually have money left over at the end of the month. Like, that's really interesting. Like, oh, hey, I was able to put an extra $200 onto my debt. Like, cool. We then move into the deep dive into sort of their relationship with money, which is where the financial trauma and so money narratives come into play. So my biggest thing is that getting good with money and personal finance isn't just about numbers, right? It's not just about the spreadsheets and all that. It's doing the deep work of like, hey, what perspectives about money do you have today, right? And where are those stemming from, right? What beliefs do you carry? Like, is money unsafe, right? Do you feel like money is limited, right? Like, why is that the case? Right. And on top of that, it's like the idea of like overspending, right? Why are you overspending in the first place? Maybe it's because you grew up in an environment where you lacked the opportunity and choice to buy yourself something that you wanted, right? And so now as an adult, you can't find, you know, the way to tell yourself no, right? And so we go through this portion of the course, which again, what it does for my clients is get rid of the sort of the shame around their finances of like, hey, I should have known better. Right, I should have done things differently. And I'm like, no, well, hold on. You are a unique human, a unique individual who grew up in this world with a unique perspective on money, right? And that influenced how you behaved. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I always say anyone in your same position would react and do the same thing, right? And so throughout my 3-month coaching program, like, this is the transformation that I'm looking for, right? Is for my clients to start becoming aware, right, of like why they're making decisions, and also gaining that confidence and reducing that shame that they hold against themselves with their finances.
Yeah. I love what you said about helping them build confidence, because I know we talked about this offline, but I also have a coaching background, but in the nutrition and fitness space. And like, the one thing I always tell my one-on-one clients when we first start working together is that my goal is not to work together forever. Like, my goal is to work with you for a period of time, equip you with the knowledge and skills so that you can feel confident handling, you know, nutrition and reaching your fitness and physique goals on your own without me. And so similarly with the coaching that you do, it's like you want to unravel all of their past and teach them the ropes so that they can feel confident, like, navigating finances on their own for the rest of their life. But I think what's interesting about your space is that, you know, your clientele are probably people who are already struggling with money as is in some way, like whether it's overspending or credit card debt or whatever their unique situation is. So like, the idea of paying for a service or paying for a money coach can feel kind of conflicting, or there might be like more of a mental hurdle for them to get past. So what are some of the big wins that you've seen from your clients or the people that have gone through your programs who are in struggling situations, like struggling, you know, financial situations, but decided to take that leap of faith and make that investment?
Yeah, for sure. So I think the first thing I want to acknowledge is that hurdle, right? Of like, hey, why would I spend money to get better with money?
Yeah.
Right. And like, that was the biggest hurdle that I definitely faced early on in my business. And my response to that is always, well, hey, your current systems with your money and your current habits with your money are giving you your current results. right? And so I'm like, well, are you satisfied with where you are, right? Yes or no? Usually the answer is no. Well, it's like, hey, well, what's going to change for you, right? 3 months, 6 months from now, right? If you keep doing what you're doing, are you going to be in a better place? Yes or no? And I'm like, hey, in 12 weeks from now, we can have a, you know, have you in a different place than where you would be maybe 6 months or 12 months on your own, right? So that's the biggest thing. It is taking that leap of faith for yourself, but it's also decisions like this should be a little bit uncomfortable, right? Because again, when we're so used to our comfort zone of like, hey, I'm okay with my credit card debt, right? Like it's, I am used to living paycheck to paycheck. That is my, what's called, so your financial comfort zone, right? And so getting out of that should feel a little bit uncomfortable. But to answer your question in detail, in terms of client wins, again, the biggest thing for me is having someone come to me who really lacked trust within themselves to make their own financial decisions and starting to do that on their own after our 12 weeks of working together, right? The biggest thing is having flexibility and adaptability. Like, hey, you know what? We have this plan, right? We're going to, you know, transfer money to your savings and your debt and all that. But hey, something unexpected comes your way, right? All of a sudden that plan is derailed. How do you react, right? They may feel that desire to kind of go back to their old ways and habits, right? But they'll always message like, hey, Parween, this thing happened, right? Instead of shutting down and avoiding my money, I went into our spreadsheet and like I started to make a change and I became more flexible and I made it work. Right? Yeah. That is my biggest take. That's my biggest thing for my clients. In addition to obviously like paying off debt or the savings and like seeing the results in their bank account. Biggest thing is the behavioral change.
Yeah. I mean, the ROI is huge if you can kind of shift your mindset to think about it as, okay, I'm paying someone, I'm investing in this so that this person can help me learn how to fish and therefore, oh, I'm so sorry. And therefore be a lot more self-sufficient and like reap the benefits for the rest of your life. I want to go back to one thing that you said earlier when you were talking about your journey and you know what you had experienced growing up as a teenager. And you mentioned this power dynamic. You know, can you talk a little bit more about that in terms of the power that money can create for you in terms of choices?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the people who say that money doesn't buy happiness are saying that from a very privileged place, because yes, maybe money won't buy happiness, but it will provide you opportunity and choice to do things differently with your life, right? Or to elevate your lifestyle. And so growing up as a kid of immigrants, you know, money was sort of a tool that was used in survival, right? Only for needs, right? It was always very scarce. And so I witnessed my parents trade a lot of time for very minimal pay, right? And kind of making the best of that situation. And so when I've gotten older, obviously now with my education and stuff like that, I was in a salary position, right? Earning more than my parents, that gave me choice and opportunity, right? To then live my life a little bit differently than how they would have, right? Mm-hmm. Just because I have that privilege of having more income coming my way. So I always say this to my clients as well, like, hey, you know, there's only so much when it comes to finances and money that we can cut. Right? Because the more we cut, the less we feel in control of our money, right? And that power kind of slips through our fingers.
Yeah.
But there's no limit to how much we can bring in, right? And bringing in more, having that extra flexibility, whether it's an extra $100 a month, extra $200 a month, right? Gives you, again, that boost of confidence and that trust in yourself to be like, you know what? I can do this, right? And give you the opportunity to, again, elevate your lifestyle in whichever way that makes sense for you.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, I love what you said, like you get more flexibility and that flexibility allows you to have more choices. And, you know, I remember I've shared this in previous episodes, but last year I took a job at this new company and literally on day two, like my gut feeling was this wasn't going to be a good fit. And over the course of the next 4 to 5 weeks, that just kept proving to be true. And it just got to a point where it was just taking a toll on my mental health. I remember waking up feeling anxious about starting the day and then going to bed feeling anxious about having to wake up and start the next day. And, you know, it was just not a good work environment for me. I felt like I was walking on eggshells. And, you know, I ended up quitting after 5 weeks. And I got very lucky in that situation in that, like, my old company basically hired me back on. But regardless of whether that was going to happen or not, I was ready to quit. And so I was just so thankful that, you know, I was in that position of knowing that I had the choice to leave. Like, I knew that I could not work for a period of time and still be okay. And I recognize a privilege behind that. But, you know, I think that whole experience just reiterated to me, you know, again, the importance of building that sense of like financial security for yourself so that when life circumstances happen, you're not staying in a miserable or unhealthy mm-hmm. situation because you mm-hmm. have no other choice.
Absolutely.
So I know I mentioned in your bio that you are a trauma of money facilitator. So I've never mm-hmm. heard of that. Tell us more about that and what exactly does that mean?
Definitely. So I hold two accreditations. One is the accredited financial counselor and the other one is the trauma of money facilitator. The trauma of money facilitator is a very unique program. It's the reason why not all people have heard about it because it's quite new. I think they've been around for maybe 2 years now. And when they came out, I was one of my money mentors in the space. And so when I saw the title Trauma of Money, I was like, yes, like this is the gap that I was missing myself as just a money coach that I wanted to be equipped with, you know, helping my clients kind of like create those, again, that awareness into why they're showing up and behaving with money today. Right. Because I started to notice that, you know, I can give someone a financial plan and the budget mm-hmm. and the debt repayment, but whether or not they commit to it is a whole different story. Right. And it's like, well, what's getting in the way of them implementing the plan? And so trauma of money is a really unique skill set of being trauma informed about our different nervous system states, about different money disorders and specific money scripts that help me, again, get a better picture of why my client is behaving the way they are today. And the best part is, too, is that when we understand how we react to money on just a biological level or psychological level, right? Mm-hmm. Again, it also removes the shame, right? Because it's like, well, there's a reason why I'm avoiding my money, right? There's a reason why I can't stop overspending. It's because, you know, my body or my brain is telling me X, Y, Z. And so the trauma of money, again, is just that knowledge of understanding that trauma influences our relationship with money today.
Yeah. I mean, money is just such a topic that has so many roots and like areas of deeper exploration. So it's mm-hmm. so great that like you're not only helping people with the transactional and the tactical stuff, but you're getting to that deeper exploration of like why they do what they do so that they can really like understand, you know, and fix that for the future.
Absolutely.
I mentioned in your introduction that you had created a net worth of $200,000 by age 28, mm-hmm. Which is amazing. Congratulations on that. So tell us a little bit more about that. Like walk us through how you were able to accomplish that.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I always say is that, you know, I do recognize my privilege in building that net worth, which is that I do live at home as, you know, a South Asian adult. And so typically when I say that, a lot of people will just kind of minimize my achievement in a way. Like, oh, well, you got lucky. And yes, like, I acknowledge the privilege for sure. But I think what's missing, like the nuance that's missing from that is that there's a cultural aspect to that, that in a collectivist culture, right, in South Asian culture, it is perfectly acceptable for adult children to live at home until they're married, right? And the reason for that is because being collectivist, we look after our elders when they need it as mm-hmm. well. And so, you know, part of my building my own net worth is so that I can provide for my parents and their retirement. Mm-hmm. And not having to worry about your parents' retirement, that is also a privilege, right? And so that's the first thing that I'll acknowledge, that there's definitely privilege there. Second thing was definitely increasing my income. Mm-hmm. When I graduated university, I was making, I think it was $38,000 a year. And as of last year, between both my 9-to-5 at the time and my business income, I brought in well over 100K. Mm-hmm. And so, again, when we talk about money is power, giving you more choice and flexibility, bringing in more income each year allowed me to do so. Because that meant that was more money for savings, that was more money for investments. Notice how I didn't say I ate, you know, ramen and like mm-hmm. beans and like cut everything and yes. like made that happen. I still traveled. I still did all those things. I still treat myself in like different ways, but it's because I have a very balanced approach where I'm also taking care of my financial goals.
Yeah.
And on top of that too is when we think again, these big lofty goals of like paying off 50K in debt, saving 100K or whatever it might be, that seems very unattainable, right? Especially when you're just starting at the beginning. So what I did was I broke down the 100K into a per paycheck plan. Like, hey, if I wanted to save this amount in 4 years, which is essentially what I did, how much would I have to set aside per paycheck, roughly, each month, right? And so that was, you know, $1,000 or whatever it was. That became more real. That became more tangible. So my recommendation is that whenever you're setting a financial goal for yourself, make it very specific. Know what action you have to take paycheck per paycheck.
Yeah. So you mentioned increasing your income, living at home, and then being more deliberate with your savings goals. So with the first two, so increasing your income, reducing your, you were living at home, so you're able to reduce your housing costs. Like, you know, housing for almost everyone is going to be the biggest monthly expense. So when we think about trying to reduce our costs, you know, that's going to be the thing that really moves the needle. But you also mentioned you work to increase your income. And a lot of the financial advice, and I know, you know, you kind of touched on this, a lot of the financial advice that's out there tends to be geared toward this like nickel and dime type advice of, you know, cut back on $5 lattes, like start couponing more so you can save 50 cents. And like, I think there's some merit to that depending on what stage of life you're in perhaps. But at the end of the day, by and large, your time is going to be better spent finding ways to increase your income. But just putting out blanket statement, you know, statements out there of like, just go increase your income isn't as easy and black and white. So what kind of advice do you have for increasing your income in various ways? And then also, you know, finding that balance between increasing income versus saving money. Like what's a good approach or some advice you have for people in like managing those two?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess to answer the first question, which is like, hey, what do I mean by increase your income, right? Like, what will that look like for you? The first place to start will be with your 9-to-5, right? And understanding that, hey, have you been there a long time and have you just not received, you know, substantial merit increases each year to account for all the hard work and I guess loyalty that you've provided for that company, right? And so if, again, I think especially as South Asian women or women in general, asking for what we're worth is very difficult, right? And negotiating salary sounds like the scariest thing, right? Ultimately, we need to think about ourselves first, right? And so where I would start was this, yeah, advocating for a raise with your 9-to-5. What would that look like? Definitely taking keeping track of detailed notes of all of your contributions to the company, value added, what projects you delivered on, right? Maybe what extra tasks and situations that you took on that were outside the scope of your role, right? When you first signed up, like, hey, has your role significantly changed in terms of tasks and stuff that you're responsible for from then, right? That is going to be your baseline in terms of your evidence for advocating for a raise, okay? First place is your 9-to-5. And if you find that the current place isn't willing to match, I would say then look elsewhere, right? Again, I think we
especially right now.
Especially right now. What are they calling? The great resignation or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Hot companies, right? There has to be someone else that will be willing to pay your worth. And there will be, right? Yeah. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is whether they call it side hustles, right? Hustle culture, all that thing is just finding an additional stream of income on top of your 9-to-5. This can look different for a lot of people, right? It may be the gig economy, right? Uber Eats or deliveries or whatever it might be, right? Which again is a lot of time, a lot of effort, and that may not be it for you. Second one might be just a part-time job, right? At a store that you might like or a company that you value, right? Working for them part-time. Third one is you leveraging your own skills, right? And whether that is maybe you're a designer, right? Or just doing some outsource or work outside of your 9-to-5 to bring in more income. So when we think about like starting a side hustle, et cetera, I always say like, what are your talents and what are your interests, right? Like is it life coaching, right? Is it money coaching? Is it being a personal trainer? Like all these things. Align your side hustle with that. Because that way, again, it won't feel too overwhelming or like burnout, et cetera, because you're still doing something that you value.
Yeah.
So those are sort of the three separate ways of like creating a side hustle income that I would recommend that people start with.
Yeah. I mean, I love especially what you said about negotiating, because like I, you know, negotiating like in your current job, because I think, you know, I don't think enough women advocate for themselves, especially as much as men do. And I think, you know, sometimes the difference can come from just advocating for yourself and negotiating for your worth. I guess the only thing I wanted to add is just like, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, increasing your income, making more money, that is going to help you the most, but it's also important to not let lifestyle inflation creep in. Like, okay, just because you get a big bump in raise doesn't mean you should immediately move into a more expensive apartment or get a new car, because, you know, falling into that cycle is inevitably going to, you know, limit your ability to turn your higher income or salary into building actual wealth. So, okay, I want to move on and talk about money specifically within like the South Asian culture. So what are some of the common themes or traumas that you've seen specific to our South Asian community, you know, when it comes to money and personal finance matters?
Yeah, like I think the first one I'll start with is definitely the gender expectations and the inequity and unfairness that it lays there. And so, you know, my clients are, again, are women. I don't work with men. And, you know, stories like, you know, them having to pay for their brother's, you know, education or finances, or, you know, watching, again, a male in the household receive financial support, but they didn't, right? And so, again, this breeds this idea that women aren't meant to be financially independent or empowered with money, right? It's like, hey, that's not your role, right? You don't need help because your future husband will take care of you, right? And so it breeds this codependency aspect of like, well, you know what? If I don't have to worry about my finances right now, then like screw it, right? That's where you start just overspending per paycheck, right? You don't have any desire to save because there's this idea that, hey, you will be saved at some point in the future when you're married or when you're with a partner.
Yes.
And I think that's just, it's a big one because like we again witness women in our community get stuck in toxic situations or toxic marriages because they're unable to leave due to financial, you know, financial issues. So that's definitely the big one, which is sort of like the gender expectations. And I don't know if you have anything that you want to add to, I guess what I stated there, but that will be definitely the first one that I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think like it's just so unfortunate that, you know, we're taught to kind of just rely on our spouse because that's not going to be reality. You know, reality very well could be that one day you find that your spouse passes away or you go through a divorce or, you know, when some of these life circumstances hit you in the face and you're like, oh shit, like I don't know how to even stand up on my own two feet because I haven't been taught that, you know, my entire life. One thing that I wanted to talk about was, so I know you mentioned this, is this idea of, you know, in our culture, it's common to financially and physically care for our parents in their elder years. So how can adult kids or, you know, our generation, like, prepare for that down the road if we know that our parents perhaps don't have lucrative retirement accounts to rely on? Like, what are some things or, you know, pieces of advice that you can provide to people who may be in that boat to minimize that burden on them while still being able to care for their parents?
Yeah, absolutely. So first thing I will say is I actually have an article about this specifically with Parents Magazine. So if you Google my name, Parween Mander, and Parents Magazine, it will pop up. And so that's where I dive into it in a lot more detail. But high level, what I would say is the first thing you want to identify is just, you know, how much is it going to cost your parents to just live in retirement, right? And so there are five categories that I want you to focus on: housing, transportation, food, utilities, and medical costs, right? And so again, it doesn't have to be 100% accurate. Just get some estimates of like, hey, you know what? Is there still going to be a mortgage? Like, do we need to hire in-house nurse or help or medication? Like, what does that all look like? Get that on a per month basis, those estimated costs, and then multiply it by 12 to get the yearly. Okay. Again, once we have some clarity into the numbers, then we can start to spring into action. Like, hey, you know what? Where are the gaps, right? Then look into your parents' income sources. Is there a pension plan? Is there social insurance, like, or assistance, right? Like, what do they qualify for? Especially, again, if they don't have lucrative retirement accounts. And then on top of that, it's then looking at your own income sources. right? And your own mm-hmm. personal finances to be like, hey, well, there's this gap between what they'll be bringing in each month and what their life is going to cost them, right? Am I then able to afford, you know, $500, $600 a month to support them in that difference? Mm-hmm. Again, yeah. The answer may be yes or no, but it's a place for you to start. And it makes this whole concept a lot less overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great breakdown. Thank you. I'll be sure to Google that and mm-hmm. share that link in the show notes for this episode. Awesome. I know I saw it was, I think it was like one of your posts or your reels that you had shared recently, but it was kind of discussing this concept of frugality that is so common in our culture, just, you know, like spending only on things that are necessary and not viewing pleasures as being acceptable ways to spend money. Yes. Can you kind of like talk a little bit more on that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely, like, again, like one of those, again, themes that I'll see with my clients, which is, again, when we grew up in an environment where money was a tool for survival, right? And we saw our parents, like, they would tell us no to, like, school trips or, like, you know, new crayons or, like, new this and that. Again, that's going to leave an impact on you. And so when we get older, right, we just don't want to tell ourselves no. But I think on top of that is, when we get to a point where we're making our own money, right, it is nice for us to spend money on things that are, again, that aren't necessary, but are just wants. Yeah. Whether it's a meal prep service, right, having someone come to clean your house, you know, once or twice a month, just so, again, that you get that flexibility, right? Maybe it's just aesthetic, like, decor for your desk, right? Which, like, again, doesn't make any sense for our parents for us to waste, quote unquote, our money on those things.
Yeah.
But for us, it's just a way for us to feel again, a little more elevated in our lifestyle. And so there's no shame in that, right? Mm-hmm. There's no shame in wanting to choosing a way to spend our money that's different from our parents, right? And I think that's what this all comes down to, which is that most of the time, the beliefs and perspectives that we hold about money aren't actually ours, right? It's stemming from our childhood, right? And how we grew up and our parents. And so that doesn't mean that has to be the way you have to, you know, spend money or make decisions with money when you have your own.
Yeah, I know I mentioned this off mic, but I get my nails done every month, and you know, it's just something I love doing. I look forward to it. It makes me feel great and more put together, and it's just part of my monthly routine. And I talk to my mom like almost every day, and every time I tell her, like, oh yeah, I just went to go get my nails done today, and every time it's the same response. Oh, you're just wasting your money. You're just wasting your money. And like, I don't see it as wasting my money because I've done all of the things that I need to do. And now I'm consciously choosing to spend money on the things that I get the most joy out of. And I'm also not spending money on random shit that I don't care about. Like, I'm not the type to just walk into Target because I'm bored and get random knickknacks that are just going to end up in the junk drawer, you know? So I think this idea of like really value-based spending, you're spending money on like what truly like you creates the most value and joy for you is so important. But when you were talking about shame, you know, that actually reminded me of, gosh, what's that one financial guru, his Dave Ramsey.
Yes.
I find Dave Ramsey to be problematic. I find his approach for teaching about money and, you know, giving financial advice to be problematic because he creates a lot of shame and guilt around the advice that he gives. He tweeted something a while ago that went viral and it got a lot of attention and there was a lot of controversy around it, but he tweeted something that said, like, if you're in debt, the only time you should see a restaurant is if you're working there. And you know, he's basically saying that, like, you can only, you know, you have to first deem yourself, quote, worthy of being able to eat at a restaurant. And, like, you know, it's so interesting because, like, I work in the health and nutrition space, like I said, and there's so many parallels to personal finance and diet culture. Like, if you're going to attempt this, like, super very extreme approach at trying to get to your end goal, chances are you're not going to be successful in the long run at all. You're just going to end up in this, like, vicious cycle of, like, depriving yourself and then going off the rails and then feeling bad about it and then saying you're just going to start all over on Monday, and then this whole cycle just repeats itself. But also, it's like, what is the point of working hard and, you know, making money if you can't enjoy any of it? So I just think, like, you know, finding that solution that is sustainable and like still allows you to, you know, be responsible and reach your goals, but also like enjoy and live your life is so important. The last thing that I'll point up about, you know, what I've seen growing up in South Asian culture is also this idea of like projecting a certain type of image, you know, like kind of like trying to keep up with the Joneses mentality. Yep. Like I remember growing up, like there in our community, there was such a focus on who had the biggest house and, you know, mm-hmm. who had the bigger wedding. And it's like, no matter what the financial situation is at home, there's this like image component that drives yes. people to make choices that may not actually align with their reality. And yep. so I really hope that that's something that will change with our generation.
And it's definitely, again, like one of those themes that comes up within coaching as mm-hmm. within the clients that I see as well, which is, again, like, what will other people think?
Yeah.
Right? Like that pervasive narrative, right? And so we will see our parents, you know, spend or go into debt for lavish weddings, right? Or for gifting, right? Even though we know they can't afford to, well, they can't show that they are struggling to, you know, the rest of the world. And so, well, how does that make an impression on you, mm-hmm. right? As you get older, as you start, again, making your own money, accumulating credit card debt and like wanting to go out with friends or like seeing your friends like be able to spend more lavishly, etc. Again, like we feel that same pressure, right, to keep up with them, even though yeah. we know that it's going to create, you know, some sort of like challenge and struggle for us. We can't help but do it because, again, these narratives drive us of like, well, hey, you know what, I want to be included.
Yeah.
Right. If I don't, then I'm going to be an outcast and that's going to be embarrassing and I don't want to do that. And so what I always tell my clients or remind my clients of, especially in this age of like social media, where we only see the best part of people's lives, which is their trips, right? And like their new handbags and all that. My question is like, is always like, what's going on behind closed doors?
Yes.
How do we not know that's not funded by credit card debt, right? Because some of my clients are coming to me with the exact same scenarios, right? They're purchasing things that are outside their means, but they have it. Right. And so when you post on social media, no one's going to question like, hey, well, yeah, like, wonder how they paid for that.
Yeah.
Right? It's this idea of like, well, hey, why can't I do the same? Right. Why am I not where they are? Right. So always remember that you just don't know what's happening behind closed doors.
Yeah. I mean, every post that you see on social media, there's so much more to that story than what it appears to be. Okay, so I know we don't have that much time left and I know you have a hard stop soon. So I just want to talk about two more things and then mm-hmm. we'll wrap up. So the first is we'll talk about money management for college students and then also finish with talking about money and relationships. So mm-hmm. let's start with college students. So I know, you know, some of my audience are college age students. So
yeah.
talk to us about money management and advice you have for students who are obviously, you know, not making money yet, but still wanting to make like wise, prudent choices for their future. Like what are some things they can do now given the minimal financial resources they have?
Absolutely. The first thing is don't treat a credit card like it's cash. I think, again, when I see some of my clients, it is choices that they made right at college or when they're in college that's still not haunting them till this day, but it's still making an impact to this day. Right. And so when it comes to a credit card, because I know on campuses, like there'll be banks there with their promotions, like, hey, there's this free card, and they're not actually teaching you how to use it. So if you do have a credit card, a couple of things, only put things on there in terms of expenses that you know you have in your savings or checking account to pay it off, mm-hmm. right? So if you go out to the bar with friends, etc., right, that $50 that you spend, make sure that you have it within your checking account so that you can pay it off and so there's no sort of like hangover or credit card debt, right? Second thing is automating your expenses. So you might be paying for like, you know, your cell phone or whatever it might be, put that onto your credit card. Okay. And then set up an automatic bank statement, bank transfer from your bank to pay off your credit card each month. This will start to build a good history in terms of your yes. credit score. What is a credit score? A credit score is basically the GPA of your adult financial life, right? It shows future lenders like the banks how responsible you are with repaying a loan and with money. Okay. And so you want this score to be as high as you can. The range is typically from like 300 to like 900, and you want to be definitely within that 600 to 900 range. So that's the first thing, is just credit card, credit score, be mindful of that.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, again, try, and again, this is a tough one, but living within your means,
mm-hmm.
right? Not overspending. And I know that's really tough as a college student. When you want to, like, you know, go on spring break trips or do all these things, right? And you're already struggling. And again, I think it's the same thing as being in survival mode,
mm-hmm.
right? When you have that broke student mentality, right?
Yeah.
Your effort, you know, like bandwidth is a lot shorter.
Yes.
Right? So I would encourage you to just practice a little bit of patience, right? If there's a girls' weekend, if there's a trip coming up, wherever it might be, instead of saying yes to it right away, hey, ask. Hey, can we move that a month or two, right? Just so I can save up for it, right? All these things. Or maybe just passing on the opportunity for now and then saving for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think that idea of like instant gratification comes into play, because again, we're in college. Maybe we're making our own money for the first time, right? And again, money is choice. And so we just want to live our lives. And we should.
Right.
Right? And we should. But I think it's just practicing that mindfulness as early as you can.
Yeah. I totally agree and resonate. Like, I remember being in college, you know, you just have so much going on in that stage of life. You have classes, you have exams, you're trying to look for internships, you're living with your girlfriends, you're trying to just have fun on the weekends. And when it comes to money, like exactly what you said, you're just in survival mode. You're just thinking about how you can buy groceries and still have money to hit up the bars.
Yeah.
And so I totally get that. And like, you know, just not having perhaps the mental bandwidth on learning all of the things around like personal finance at that stage of your life. But I think like what you said, you know, goes so far of just being mindful of living within your means and debt management and things like that. I think if I could have gone back in time, I think I was like pretty, you know, responsible when it came to like money and credit cards and things like that in college. But if I could have gone back in time, I think I would have try to spend that summer after graduation, like reading personal finance books. You know, there's so many great books out there, like, you know, and so many resources out there today. Like, there's, I'm a huge Ramit Sethi fan, but I read his book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. And like, I wish I read that book when I was 22, when I was 22. And, you know, now there's so many other resources, especially with social media, like people like you who are there. There's so many other like, you know, financial influencers or whatever you want to call them who are creating really valuable educational content that's easy to digest. It's bite-sizable. And I think, you know, if you are in college and perhaps getting ready to start the real world, just like it's, you know, just spending some time up front, really learning, like reading books, maybe paying for a couple sessions with a money coach that they trust and can relate to, like all of those things can go a long way in terms of setting up the systems early to be like financially sound and secure and successful. Okay, so I want to move on and talk about money and relationships. So when it comes to divorce, money is tagged as one of the most common reasons for why couples get divorced. And I really believe that you should be having conversations about money with your partner well before you ever get ever get engaged. But at the same time, our culture very much conditions us to think that talking about money is shameful. You're not supposed to talk about money. It's rude. And so that leads people to shy away from having these money conversations until it's too late. So what kind of advice do you have for couples to kind of break away from that stigma and start having healthy conversations about money as early as possible in their relationships?
Absolutely. The first thing I would recommend doing is that we want to make sure it's a safe space for both partners to talk openly about finances, right? So this is where I would say scheduling what's called like a money date, right? It could be once a month. It could be every 6 months, whatever it might be. Just something where we know that the topic is going to be around finances, right? You guys get some wine out. You guys like make it an enjoyable experience, right? So first thing, again, was setting aside intentional time as a money date between both couples. The second thing is, especially when it's just you're just starting these conversations, is don't talk numbers, talk values. Okay? I think where a lot of like the nitty gritty sort of arguments and the discourse and the negativity comes from, like, picking at one another's, like, you know, spending habits, or like, why did you spend that much money there? Why, where did that money go? And all that stuff. When we start with that as like the premise of the conversation, of course, it's going to be an unsafe and uncomfortable conversation, right? That leads to, you know, arguments, et cetera. So we want to avoid that. And the way we avoid that is by first just setting, you know, hey, how do you want to sort of leverage money to kind of elevate your lifestyle, right? Is it going on trips, right? Is it spending money monthly on your nails? Okay, if so, why? Help me understand, like, why getting your nails done is important to you, et cetera, right? Again, just talking about values, how you want to use money as a tool to elevate your own lifestyle. And from there, finding joint financial goals that you both want to work towards, right? It's like, hey, we want to have a destination wedding in 3 years. Okay, great. What's that going to look like for us, right? Or, you know, we want to be going on big trips like once a year or twice a year. Okay, great. What does that mean in terms of how we budget each month, right? To make sure that it happens for us, right? Finding a collective goal for both parties to rally around will then make conversations about, you know, the actual numbers a lot easier, because that's something for you to both rally to. Hey, you know what? We're talking about this because ultimately the goal we want to achieve X is X, right? So what are you willing to compromise on, and what am I willing to compromise on? Right. See how that's a lot more of a healthier and safe discussion around opening up, again, about money that, again, won't lead to the nitpicking arguments and stuff like that. So again, stock values and not numbers.
Yeah, I love what you said, like talking about your values and like the things that are most important to you to, you know, feel like you're living your most authentic, happiest life. And I think it's so important to also like be really honest about that and not hold anything back out of fear of judgment or that it might turn them away, because, you know, like not being honest about that kind of stuff is typically what can lead people down the road to feel resentment. And, you know, 5 years later, it's like, oh, I used to do a lot of XYZ and I haven't been able to do any of that for the last five years because my partner doesn't want me to spend money on that or whatever. So I think, you know, just I really believe, like, if you're talking about money and values, money and like the values that dictate, you know, how you spend your money and money habits for the first time, and you already either have a ring on your finger in the form of like being engaged or married, like it's too late. Like, it's just so important to start talking about that as early as possible. So one thing that I've been noticing that is becoming more common, I think for, you know, for married couples, is to keep their finances separate and not do joint accounts. So I'd love to kind of like hear, you know, your inputs on that. Like, traditionally people get married and then everything becomes one and the same, including joint bank accounts. But I think we're seeing more millennial couples who are choosing to keep things separate. You know, like I've seen in my Venmo feed plenty of times, like married couples Venmoing each other rent money or money for groceries or, you know, whatever other shared expenses. And obviously, like, whether you choose to combine finances or not is totally a personal decision. It's going to vary couple to couple. There's no right answer or wrong answer. But like, talk to us about why couples may choose to take this route, you know, of keeping finances separate even after marriage. Like, what are the pros and cons of each?
Yeah, for sure. I think what you said there was really important too, which is that there's no right answer, right? For it depends couple per couple. Like, they may choose to combine everything because that's just easier for both of them. Like, they don't want to deal with transfers and any of that stuff. There's like one pot, it's all good, right? And so again, totally cool if that works for you. I think the benefit of splitting or keeping finances separate is that it allows each partner to, again, maintain that idea of agency and independence, right? And so there is no crossover of like, again, hey, like, why are you spending money that way? And why are you spending that money that way? Right. As long as you're both taking care of the joint household expenses, which is the important part. Right. And then having some alignment on like some of the savings goals that maybe both are working towards, that, again, are joint. Maybe it's a trip, maybe it's a wedding or whatever it might be. Right. That works. Right. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think my biggest thing out of everything, whether it's expenses or savings or whatever, you're spending money. Right. So the money that you're going to spend on like takeout and like, you know, retail and like coffee, whatever that is, needs to be separate. That 100% needs to be separate. Even in this world of like the people that combine everything, I would still say at least give each partner a spending allocation. Maybe it's 500, 500, right? Mm-hmm. That is money on a per month basis that they can spend on whatever the heck they want.
Yeah.
On whatever they want. And it does not matter to the other person what they spend that on, right? Because everything else is already taken care of. Household yes. expenses, savings goals, etc. Right? And again, so when we talk about where is that sense of like the arguments or the root of arguments is typically how the other person's spending their money. Right. And so my biggest tip would be at least separate that.
Yeah. Yeah. I personally like the idea of combining everything, but then also like exactly what you said, having some account that is each our own, where yep. it's like, okay, no questions asked, whatever you want to spend it on kind of yep. account. And, you know, I feel like that at least helps in terms of creating some healthier boundaries.
Yeah. And one other thing I would also say to that as well, and when it comes to like actually figuring out how to split expenses and joint, you know, goals and stuff like that, a lot of people think like, oh, 50-50, mm-hmm. right? For fairness, like equality, like 50-50. Not necessarily, right? If you have one person earning 100K and the other person earning 50K, right? 50% of the household expenses for the person earning 50K may be like 70% of their income.
Yeah.
Whereas for the other person, maybe 30%, right? And so another thing that I would recommend is splitting expenses based on equity, right? Not equality. So what that means is just how much of a percentage are the joint expenses taking out of per person's income, right? And making that percentage a lot more even. So 40% for each person, right? Or 20% for each person or whatever it might be. So that might mean that the person earning more takes on more of the expenses. And I know that can sound a bit icky to some people, mm-hmm. but again, we want to make sure that both partners are able to, you know, save, right? Build some sort of like financial independence, but also feel really good about contributing to the household without feeling stressed and overwhelmed by it.
Yeah.
That's yeah. another point of contention as well. It's like, hey, you earn more money than me, right? Like, hey, I'm struggling over here. Like, you're earning more, et cetera. So that's one way to avoid that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Such, oh my gosh, such great, great advice. I know we are almost out of time, so we'll wrap up. I know you recently launched a new workshop or product mm-hmm. offering. So tell us about that and then also tell us how they can find you, follow yeah. you, work with you.
All that good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just came out with my How to Stop Overspending workshop. It's available for $49. It's one of my lower ticket offers. I'm very, very excited to have this out finally. And so again, if one-on-one coaching may not be the right investments for you, I still want you to start making meaningful changes, especially with your spending habits. And so this workshop and module is on demand. It's not live. And it's actually one of the exact modules from inside my one-on-one coaching program. So you'll get a sneak peek into kind of how I operate. But again, I want you to start making meaningful changes. So if you're someone that gets to the end of the month and you're just like not happy with where your money went, knew you overspent, right? And just can't get yourself out of that cycle of doing so, this workshop's for you. Okay. On top of that, if you want to connect with me, I'm on Instagram at parween.mander. My website's always linked in my bio. It is www.thewealthywolf.ca. And I have a free resource as well called Where Did My Money Go? So again, if you want, it's a good place to start. Grab that and get on my email list because I email you guys monthly with a monthly money challenge. So lots of places to connect with me and get some goodies.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll be sure to add all of those links to the show notes. Thank you so much for Parween. Thank you so much, Parween, for coming on the show. It was truly such a delight to have you. I think the work and the mission that you do is so valuable. So thank you. And thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much, Julie. Appreciate it.